They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back. Crossover NBA Podcast. On this episode, got a great conversation with Steven Silas, the new head coach of the Houston Rockets. I am a big fan of Steven Silas as a basketball coach. He's one of those young up-and-coming coaches that has earned his place among the better assistant coaches in the NBA and earned this opportunity in Houston. I talked to Steven about that opportunity, from the phone call he made to his father, the great Paul Silas, to almost getting this job in Houston 4 years ago, to taking this Rockets job when, quite frankly, it's a difficult job. A lot of people around the NBA think the Rockets have plateaued. I talked to Steven about everything that goes into this Houston Rockets job. A little bit later on, Jeremy Wu, SI.com NBA draft analyst. The NBA draft, finally, just about a week away. I talked to Jeremy about what the latest chatter is as far as trades go, what the future of the number two pick with Golden State is, LaMelo Ball, maybe some risers and some fallers. Go through it all with Jeremy Wu of SI.com. Before we get to those discussions, a quick thought on Tommy Heinsohn, the longtime Celtics legend who passed away on Tuesday at the age of 86. I had the privilege of not only growing up watching Tommy, listening to Tommy in the Boston area, I had a chance to work with Tommy as a part-time employee, analyst, sideline reporter with NBC Sports Boston. He was a legend, a giant among giants. One of the great figures, not just in Boston basketball history, but in NBA history. He had a hand in or was a part of the Celtics organization for all 17 of their championships. He won them as a player. He won them as a coach. And he won them in his role as a broadcaster. He is a playing Hall of Famer, a coaching Hall of Famer, and he should be a broadcasting Hall of Famer. So I won't get too deep into it here. If you want to hear more from Tommy, 4 years ago, I did a terrific podcast with him that's on this feed. You go back to about December of 2016. I also tweeted the direct link on my account. That's at SI Chris Mannix. Check that podcast out. He has a remarkable story and so many tales to tell about his time playing with the great Bill Russell, working with Red Auerbach, to all the current day iterations of the Celtics. It's a great conversation. I encourage you to go back and listen to that. While you're at it, subscribe to this podcast, rate, review, all that good things, those good things. It really helps when you do that for the podcast. All right, without further ado, my conversation with Steven Silas. All right, Steven Silas is maybe not a household name amongst average sports fans, but in NBA circles, he is well-known, well-respected, accomplished a lot in his career as an assistant coach with the Golden State Warriors, Charlotte Hornets, most recently with the Dallas Mavericks. And now he is the head coach of the Houston Rockets. And Steven, kind enough to join me here on the show. Steven, I've known you a long time, man. Congratulations. You certainly, you know, came up the hard way, you know, earning this opportunity, bouncing from assistant job to assistant job. How are you feeling about all this?
Man, I'm feeling unbelievable. I feel so good about this. And like you said, it's been a long time. And you wouldn't think, being the son of a former NBA player and former coach, that it would be such a hard, long, arduous journey. But it has been, and it makes it so much more sweet.
Tell me about the phone call between you and your father, just to let him know that you had your first head coaching job.
It was amazing. He had been telling me all along, like, you're going to get this job. Even when I told him the first time I was interviewing for Houston, he was like, I have a good feeling about this one. I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, we've had good feelings before, so we'll just go through the process and see how it goes. But the longer it went, he was like, I'm telling you, I have a good feeling about this. And then when I called him after I'd spoken to Rafael Stone, and he had offered me the job. I called him and he was like, I told you, I told you. And he was so excited. And like, I haven't seen him that excited in forever, first of all. But then he had to quickly put the phone down and call all his old teammates and former people he's worked with and the Willis Reeds of the world, you know, just all the old school former NBA guys. He had to brag about his son. So it was an amazing moment, one I'll remember forever.
You got your first crack at NBA coaching on your father's staff in Cleveland. And as I said at the top, you've earned your reputation around the league in various stops to this point. But in the beginning, like, how much did you have to fight the perception of nepotism that, you know, here you are, the son of the coach, getting the job on the Cavaliers staff?
It was hard, you know, and I actually started in Charlotte with the original Hornets. So we had a veteran group, you know, Baron Davis was a rookie, but besides that, he had David Wesley and Bobby Fills and Anthony Mason. And then you have the next group that we had, which was PJ Brown and Eldon Campbell and Jamal Mashburn. So, and Stacey Augmon. So I was like the young guy, let alone being the coach's son. So it was definitely difficult. And I found myself a lot of times trying to separate myself from my dad or, you know, do things in a different way and kind of figure out a way to help and find my own style. And it was great because I was able to do that. But I also had my dad who had my back and believed in me, and I could ask dumb questions and that sort of thing. But in that situation, it really made me prepare and work and overwork and always be available to the players so they knew that they had a resource that they could depend on. And all players just want to get better. And that was my goal, to help players get better.
I apologize. It was Charlotte first, then on to Cleveland after that. Did you try – in those early years – were you trying to carve a niche for yourself with young guys? Because you did work with Steph and Clay in Golden State. You did have a young group of guys in Charlotte to work with. Did you, you know, try to pick a lane in a way to try to improve yourself as a coach?
Yeah, that's kind of how it ended up, because I was the young guy. I was 27 when I first started, and, you know, I was single, and these guys were older and had families, and, you know, it was just, you know, Baron was the first one, and he was the one who I related to. We listened to the same music. I used to go out to LA and spend time with him at UCLA and just kind of be around. So that's kind of how it started, being the young guy. And then in subsequent stops, the player development piece wasn't such a big part of it as much as it is now. And that's kind of where I gravitated to. And like you said, when I went to Golden State and working for Don Nelson, it was very much a case of figure it out, young fella. and that's kind of what I did, you know, working with the young guys, the Anthony Morrows, the CJ Watsons, the Anthony Tollivers, as well as Steph. So that's kind of the lane that I fell into, but it all started with working with Baron and being the young guy.
You've worked with some incredible basketball minds in your career, beginning with your father, of course, who's got a long history as a player and a coach. You mentioned Don Nelson. You go to Charlotte, some good basketball minds there as well. You know, you finished last year at Rick Carlisle. Who has most shaped your philosophies as a basketball coach? Or is it several people?
Yeah, I'd have to say it's several people. So starting with my dad, his ability to let players know how much confidence he has in them, and his ability to just connect with players was amazing. He could get on them and get on them hard, but also put his arm around them. And to this day, the players just love my dad. And so taking that from him, and then kind of thinking outside the box, the Nelly small ball, you know, playing Al Harrington at the five against Yao Ming and stuff like that, playing zone and boxing one and all these, you know, ideas that a lot of teams are doing now, he was doing way back then. So the thinking outside the box and being innovative is definitely a Nelly thing. Working with Steve Clifford was all about the details and the preparation and all of the things that go into being a first-time head coach and commanding the room and the team. He does it so well in a normal kind of way, and especially with the experiences that he had, and working with Patrick Ewing was great in that situation as well. And then to cap it off, working for Rick Carlisle was the thing that I believe put me over the top. I felt like I was prepared to be a head coach prior to working with Rick, but you know, he's a championship coach. He's going to be a Hall of Famer. He has adapted in so many different ways over his career with different lineups, different teams. You know, you think of the team that he had in Indiana versus the team that won the championship in Dallas to the team that he has now. And he's such a innovator and so adaptable to today's NBA. But, you know, he told me some things that I needed to do better to be a head coach. And I listened to him and leaned on him. And he was a huge advocate for me going from an assistant coach to a head coach. And I'm so appreciative to him for that. So I wouldn't say one guy, because I've worked for so many great guys. It's definitely a mixture of all of them.
You've been a candidate for head coaching jobs frequently over the last few years. In fact, you were a candidate for this job just 4 years ago. Yeah. With the Rockets. I mean, is it strange in a way to be settling into the head coaching chair in Houston 4 years after you thought you might have had a shot at getting that job in Houston?
It is and it isn't, because I did think I was ready for that position, and they've told me that I was close. Mm-hmm. You know, I was close to getting that job, but I really do think that I'm so much more prepared today than I was 4 years ago. I am a first-time head coach, but when I was in Charlotte, Coach Clifford got sick, and I coached 21 games, a month and a half of coaching the team and doing all that being a head coach entails, whether it's media or coaching the games or disputes with players or team meetings and all that stuff. So that was something that I got after the Houston experience the first time. And as I alluded to earlier, working for Rick Carlisle was amazing. And all of the things that I learned with him, as well as learning from Luka and learning from KP and learning from that organization, really prepared me for this step.
As you enter this job, do you go into it with any prior relationships with James Harden and Russell Westbrook outside of kind of the normal, they know who you are, you know who they are?
No, not at all. We say what's up. We saw each other in the bubble and say hello, but that was it. We didn't have a friendship or a connection beyond that. Part of the interview process was FaceTiming those guys and getting their point of view and letting them know my vision and answering questions that they had, which were very good questions and concerns that they had about the team going forward. So it's going to be a building process with those guys and with great players. They don't just trust right away, and they shouldn't. You know, it's going to be day after day, practice after practice, game after game, to where we have a great bond and they know where I'm coming from. They know what I'm talking about, and it'll be good. But I'm definitely looking forward to working with those guys, and I appreciate them, giving the word to the powers that be that I could be the guy.
And you take this job, and as I've said multiple times, you deserve this job, and now you get to the part of doing the job. And this is, I mean, you understand, as you know, around the league, this is widely viewed as a difficult job. It just is. I mean, you have a team here that is, you know, still strong at the top with James and Russ, but there is a perception around the league that maybe the Rockets have plateaued. Maybe they've seen their best days. What's your mindset on that? I mean, how do you see this team getting to that championship level, which I know is obviously the mandate of this team?
Yeah. You know, there's two parts of it. There's the Russ and James part of it, which is so attractive, and they're two of the best players in the NBA, two former MVPs, and soon at some point after they retire, they'll be Hall of Famers, and they're great, and there's so much there. But then there's, you know, Eric Gordon, and there's PJ Tucker, and there's Covington, and you know, the young guys, House and McLemore. There's a lot there. So for me coming into this situation, and this being my first foray as a head coach, I couldn't ask for anything more. A lot of times I would get a job that would be a rebuild, or, you know, maybe they're trying to lose a few games to get picks or whatever like that. This opportunity for me is a win now opportunity, and that's what I want. I'm a win now coach, you know, so it's great. And I look forward to seeing what we're going to do with the roster. Obviously, there are some spots that need to be filled, and the whole small ball versus playing a little bit bigger. Hopefully we'll have some wiggle room as far as what we're able to do with that on both ends of the floor. But it's exciting to me for my first job to be with this team and this owner and this group. Like, this is, I'll take it.
This job is the definition of hitting the ground running. You are probably going to be in camp within a month. How do you approach, you kind of touched on it, finding a balance with small ball and playing a little bit bigger depending on the roster. But when you went up against the Rockets, did you look at the way they played as being a way that can win a championship? Playing that style of basketball, which was unquestionably unique, but certainly could be exposed against different types of teams.
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, preparing for this team, you just kind of think about how can you beat them. You don't really think about, are they a championship contender or anything like that. They were so hard to play against because of the talent on the floor and the space that they played with. You know, the meetings that we had in Dallas with Houston were high scoring affairs because they were so hard to guard. And that's something that's going to stay, and hopefully I'll be able to enhance that a little bit. But the thing for me and this group is to have multiple ways of playing. I think at times you can get stuck in one way of playing, whether it's just isolation or it's just small or it's just pick and roll, or on the defensive end it's just switching. And today's NBA, you have to be able to do multiple things, and that'll be part of the, like you said, the short period of time between now and training camp and then training camp in the regular season is going to be difficult to kind of put my stamp on the team while making sure that the players are healthy and are allowed that ramp up to where they're at peak condition as the season starts.
Before I let you go, what does your Rolodex look like when it comes to Hall of Fame level players that you can tap into? You mentioned your dad made some phone calls, your father, of course, you know, three-time champion, accolades all over the place. Can we expect like a Hall of Fame level contingent kind of rolling through Houston periodically just to check in on Rockets practices? I mean, who can you tap into as resources outside of the organization?
Wow, that's a really good question. I used to work for the Retired Players Association. That was my first job out of college. So, you know, Dave Cowens was someone that I spoke to all the time, and Dave Bing was someone I spoke to, Oscar Robertson, those guys. There's always someone somewhere that I've had contact with, either through the Retired Players Association or my dad. So, who knows who could roll through. I know Patrick Ewing. I'm super close with Patrick, and we've been texting back and forth, and he's so excited. So he has his hands full at Georgetown, but I know he's going to be a big cheerleader and hopefully make it down to Houston and be a big part. But, some of my dad's cronies, they'll be rolling through for sure.
Was this always the dream for you? I mean, you grew up in the Northeast. You went to Brown. I mean, when did this become the dream for you to coach an NBA team?
Kind of when I first started working for my dad. Like I said, right out of college, I worked for the Retired Players Association, which used to be in Providence, Rhode Island. So it was an easy move from Brown to the Retired Players. But then my dad became the coach of the Charlotte Hornets and brought me down as a scout. And then I moved on to the bench. And as soon as I hit that bench, the thing about the NBA, man, and you know this so well, there is not a game that you play that there's a play that happens where you're like, oh, wow, I've never seen anything like that before. And it happens game after game after game. And I got the bug watching those guys play and watching my dad lead and then working for other guys and see how they lead and see how they can affect players and affect change and affect those around them. That was the goal all along. So I've reached my goal. Now I have new goals, which is win a championship.
Well, Steven, it's always good when guys like you deserve these opportunities, get these opportunities, and you're certainly a deserving choice for this Rockets job. Good luck, man. I know it's going to be a whirlwind next 4 weeks, and looking forward to seeing you as a head coach sometime during the season.
Yes, sir, Chris, and I appreciate your support over the years, man. We used to be in that Celtics locker room 3 hours before games, chopping it up. So,
now
a long way from there.
Now we're starting to really make ourselves look old, man. We're talking my old ball boy days, and oh god! But it's always good to have. And you grew up in the Boston area too, right? Or Boston and New York.
Yeah. I mean, I was born in Boston when my dad was winning championships, and then. You know, being in Providence, where are you going to go? You're going to go to Boston. So I have a soft place in my heart for Boston, for sure.
You need like daily Zoom calls with your dad and Tommy Heinsohn just to get like, you know, unsolicited advice on your offensive sets. I'm sure that'll.
Oh, man, I can't wait to see Tommy. I can't wait to see him because I know he'll have something crass to say.
Absolutely. Steven, good luck, man. Good to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Coming up next, my conversation with Jeremy Wood. All right, so we are about a week away from the NBA draft, a unusually timed NBA draft because of the pandemic, moving from June to mid-November, but no less intrigue in this one, especially with a top-tier team like Golden State at the top, a polarizing player like LaMelo Ball in the mix, and a lot of uncertainty, you know, after you get past, you know, maybe the first couple of picks. Maybe the first couple of picks have some uncertainty there. Talk about that and much more. Let's bring in Jeremy Wu, SI.com's NBA draft analyst. He's got a lot on his plate this week, and I'm glad, Jeremy, we could connect to do this before the draft. I know you're busy, man. I appreciate the time.
Of course, yeah. It's just, you know, this week every year is a little bit hectic. And, you know, on one hand, we've had a lot of time to think about the draft. So it's not quite as much of like, you know, it's not like it's creeping up. But then knowing that we have free agency right after and the season is in almost like a month, like it's crazy. It's, I didn't even really realize now it's just like, bam, you know, there's no break. But,
you know, it's interesting. I mean, you talk to more, you know, executives involved with the draft process than I do, but the ones I've talked to, they haven't exactly been doing a lot over the last month. I mean, most of the guys I've talked to have been like, look, we were prepared for June. You know, nothing has changed really since June. So it's, you know, at least the ones I've talked to, it hasn't been like they've, you know, revisited what they thought, you know, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, whatever it was. You know, time is a flat circle nowadays. But it's not, they seem to just have been prepared. They're kind of just sitting back waiting for this day.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm sure these trade conversations are starting now really to happen in earnest this week. From what I gather, like, you know, the moratorium obviously is going to get lifted next week, but it's already starting to happen. You know, now I think teams have just shifted into what is going to happen mode. And, you know, it's obviously starts at the top working down with a lot of trade activity, but yeah, I think in terms of, you know, personnel work and background, like all that stuff has been done for a long time. And I think teams have a good feel, at least for the pool. So
all your work is up on SI.com, whether it's your latest mock draft, player rankings, all of it. Over the last few months, has there been a lot of movement in your mock draft, specifically then in the last few weeks? I mean, how much movement and variance has there been with your mock drafts?
Yeah, absolutely. So I haven't done, the last one I did was I think about a month ago, and I'll have another one coming out next week. You know, once we get closer to the draft, it'll be updated more. But, you know, in reality, I'm updating this thing every day. You know, I have a big Google Doc. It's, you know, if it was a movie where, you know, how they're trying to solve a case and you got like the red strings and you got the photos and all that stuff on the wall, like that's what it's like, but it's a Google Doc. And so for me, it's just like, I'm constantly trying to put this thing together. So it changes constantly, but I would say like my feel for the top of the draft hasn't really changed. You know, there are names that, like, for example, like a Patrick Williams, who's a hot name, who is now almost definitely going to be a top 10 pick. You know, there's been a little bit of movement like that. But the further down you go, it's still tough just because I think there's a whole range of picks that are, you know, available to get traded in the teens. So there's some hold up with that. And right now it's just the whole process of working down is just taking longer until I think the lottery sort of becomes a little bit clearer.
So as far as storylines go, what's the one or ones that interest you the most over the next 7-8 days?
Yeah, I think I'm still very interested to see what Golden State does. I think they're in probably a better position to move that pick than Minnesota may be with number one. But I think those two picks are going to be what we're talking about for a while. But the Golden State really interests me because I do think, from their perspective, I think the expectations are a little bit more realistic maybe than what Minnesota might want for one. You know, Golden State, knowing, you know, we know they want to win soon, ASAP. And we also know that they're trying to preserve cap space so they can be, you know, go back next year if they have to be flexible to, you know, maybe add more talent on a big money deal. So, you know, I'm interested to see where and how Golden State ends up. I do think they'll end up moving back in the draft. I'm not sure where, but I do think there's a good chance that happens. And then obviously Minnesota, you know, I mean, so what I've heard is that, you know, people think LaMelo is going to fall. I have not really heard any strong consensus that LaMelo is going to go first. And so the Edwards LaMelo kind of yo-yo thing there, I'm sure is something that will be kind of on the radar too, over the next week, a lot.
Is there a consensus at number one right now?
I mean, I wouldn't venture enough to say that it's a consensus, in terms of like what is going to happen. But I will say, like, I think from what I have gathered, like, people seem to think Minnesota may end up staying put. And you know, my gut has always been Edwards. I don't know if that's necessarily the consensus, but I have heard that thought a lot. LaMelo, I think I'm hearing more that, you know, maybe he does fall to Charlotte at three, maybe Charlotte passes, maybe he gets there to four for Chicago. And see, that's part of the issue, is that, you know, I'm sure Minnesota right now, I know, is making calls there. You know, they're opportunistic front office. You know, they're going to do as much as they can to try to milk the value, you know, find the best deal for that pick. But if it's not there, and if people think that LaMelo is going to be available further down the board, you know, if you're trying to trade up and get him, you don't have to necessarily trade with Minnesota. So the market is tricky. And, you know, if you want Wiseman, well, you can probably trade with Golden State because, you know, Minnesota is probably not going to be the team that takes him. So, and obviously, you know, I know we're going to talk about Wiseman a little bit later. I know you spent time with him, but it's a really interesting dynamic with those three players in the top four or five picks.
Do you think that Minnesota doesn't take Wiseman because it doesn't seem like he wants to be there, or, you know, they prefer somebody else? Because, I mean, look, I don't know if Wiseman and Karl-Anthony Towns could play together, but I mean, aren't you in a position if you're Minnesota to just take the best player on the board? I mean, no matter what, in that case?
Yeah, I think for me, that from my perspective, the Towns thing is going to be a factor. I don't think defensively, I just think you're putting yourself at risk trying to teach one 7-footer to play defense and then trying to get another player who hasn't played much defense to suddenly play defense at the same time. You know, Towns obviously is pretty mobile, but just has not, you know, remember his rookie year, you know, we thought that he might be a really good defender, and that has just not been what has happened. And so, you know, I just don't know. Now, again, the alternative thought here, maybe you just decide, hey, we're going to go all offense. We're going to just, like, try to build the most talented team possible. And, you know, Gerson Rosas coming from Houston, obviously a place where they were willing to kind of break convention in terms of how they built lineups around their stars. But then again, I think if you're trying to make that type of team, then maybe LaMelo is the pick, right? And or maybe Edwards is the pick. But I think Wiseman, the fit is just, like, I'll put it this way. I've said this before in other places, but, you know, with Wiseman, you know, if you're taking him hoping to cultivate him as a trade asset, well, you need to take him and be in a situation where you can play him. But Minnesota, I just don't think, if they're making the pick thing, let's take the best player and maybe make a move later. Well, I just don't know if you can put Wiseman in a situation right away where he's going to look good, right? As opposed to Golden State, where obviously if James Wiseman's playing 25 minutes a game with Draymond, Steph, and Clay, he's probably going to look pretty good because he's not going to have to do all that much. So I think that factors in. For me, it's more likely going to be Edwards, just from what I've heard too.
Yeah, and look, if Edwards is the most talented player, if he's number one on their draft boards, of course you take him. I just get sometimes a little leery of teams that draft based on need, right? Like Edwards clearly fills a role that the Timberwolves have available. D'Angelo Russell's the point guard. Karl-Anthony Towns is the center. You know, Edwards slides into that mix pretty well, but I would hope that they're convinced he's the top guy, you know, on their draft board. I mean, because if you know they don't draft Wiseman and Wiseman goes on, or even LaMelo, whoever it is, and that player goes on to be the most productive player in the draft, and that's not going to reflect well on the team that passes on him.
Right, absolutely. I agree with that for sure. You have to really believe in him to take him no matter what. But I do think with Edwards, I mean, in my opinion, I think he almost has gotten the short end of the stick in terms of how he's been covered. Like, I don't know. With him, you know, I watch a lot of his games. You know, I've watched all these guys. But Edwards, I think for me, and it's come back to the factor, just he is so young. I don't know that necessarily is a bad field player like some people think. I think he's just really young. And I think, you know, I've talked to Tom Crean a couple of times about this. And, you know, obviously he's going to, you know, make the pitch for his player, but, you know, you can tell when you talk to him, and, you know, Tom would probably agree with me on this, that, you know, he really does believe in the kid. And, you know, talent-wise, Edwards is not lacking in any way. You know, he might be, in terms of just raw, you know, athletic talent, he can really score, he can pass, he's going to be able to guard. Like, all these things, he has to learn to do them, and you're going to have to maybe do a little bit of hand-holding to make sure that he you know, reaches his potential. But you know, sometimes I hear people throwing out the Deion Waiters thing with him, like as a worst case. I just think that's so lazy because Waiters was, you know, a little bit overweight coming out of college. And it was kind of a guy who had underachieved, right? The perception was he was an underachiever coming off a really good year. Edwards is a guy who, you know, his trajectory is different. He all of a sudden, for the first time in his life, was thrown into an adverse situation in Georgia. And I think he did pretty well. Like, I don't think people give him enough credit for just sticking through a whole season, you know, making improvements and kind of learning to be more of a shooting guard as opposed to just a basketball player. So I'm a little bit more optimistic with him, I think, than most people are going to find. But I see the raw talent there. Like, I don't think there would be any reason to knock Minnesota for just taking Edwards.
So how convinced are you that Golden State does move out of that spot? Because if Edwards goes to Minnesota, it would seem like Wiseman is a natural fit in Golden State. I mean, I don't know if he's NBA ready. I mean, the guy hasn't played really competitive basketball outside of a handful of games in, you know, well over a year. But, you know, he's a super athletic, you know, runs the floor, shot blocking, rim protecting big man. And Golden State's got some decent young bigs. Eric Pascal was a good player for them last year, but that's somebody that you would think would fit into the way Golden State wants to play. I mean, how certain are you, how convinced are you that the Warriors trade out of that spot?
I think there's a good chance that it happens. Just, I think there's been enough interest in Wiseman. I think people have the sense that they have to get in front of Charlotte to get him. I don't know if that means Charlotte will come up. Like, that's a different question. I don't know if that happens if they were to try to get in front of two with Minnesota. But point being, like, I think Golden State is in a pretty good spot. Because I think also their expectations are more realistic, right? If you think about the type of player who they're targeting, like, look, if I'm Golden State and I'm trying to move down from two, I really would have two goals in mind. It would be one, find a way to get off of Wiggins' contract, because that's going to hamper them in free agency over the next couple of years. And the sooner they can move it, the better, right? And if you have to attach the pick and just get a later lottery pick to do that, I think that's fine. And if you look at what they've done in terms of what, you know, obviously a lot has leaked about their draft, but they've been working out guys, who are supposed to be picked further down in the lottery as well, right? So you know that I think we can be sure that they're preparing for those types of contingencies further down the board. My guess is I think they'll find a team who's like, you know what, whatever, we'll take the money. We likewise, and we'll come up and we'll do this. And if Golden State gets the cap relief, they still get a young player that they like, and they get a player who's going to be a starter for them immediately and allow them to be a contending team. I don't see why you wouldn't do it, just particularly thinking about the long-term financial implications.
Who do you think are the candidates to do that, to move into that spot?
I mean, if you look at the lottery, I mean, you can really work down. I mean, obviously Detroit is a team that has come up trying to move up. Now, do they necessarily have enough? Would they, you know, they're willing, obviously, I think a team that is willing to take salary. So maybe the Wiggins thing is a non-starter there. Would Golden State want Blake Griffin? I don't know the answer to that. Probably not, right? But if Detroit were to try to put together a package there, but Golden State move back, they're still, you know, going to pick up a player that makes them better. Maybe Blake's contract is too long, right? But, you go further down, you know, New York. I don't know if New York has enough to put that type of deal together, right? But I'm sure that they, if they felt like they had to get that high for Ball, maybe they're interested. And you could look at San Antonio is sitting there at 11 with, I don't know, like, if you look at their cap sheet, LaMarcus Aldridge is an expiring contract who kind of fits Golden State's window. So maybe that becomes someone you call. I don't think Boston can get that high with their three firsts. Or maybe it's a team, maybe Indiana, right? They don't have a pick. Maybe Indiana's like, hey, we'll give you like Miles Turner and another player to get into the draft. Now that obviously Golden State doesn't pick up another lottery pick in that scenario, but teams like that, I think those are the types of moves that you would probably think about as rational for Golden State. And that's like my guess as to what they might explore.
Boston's interesting to me because it seems like every year or every other year, they have three first-round draft picks or multiple first-round draft picks. And they haven't been great on hitting on those picks. Now, maybe Romeo Langford, who had some injury issues last year, he develops into a player. But yeah, over the years, you know, those picks that are in the back half of the first round, many of them haven't panned out for the Celtics. I mean, what do you think their mindset's going to be in this draft?
Yeah, I'm sure that they will. Like, I feel pretty sure that they will do something. I don't know if that means they consolidate all three of the firsts or if they just move two of them. I do think it's a pretty decent role player draft. So 26 and 30 are like decent picks. They'll probably, if they want a player at one of those spots, they'll be able to get someone they like. But maybe they combine two to move up. It depends on how many rookies they want to roster. I can't see them rostering more than two. And it's going to create a crunch with Langford and Robert Williams and Carson Edwards, whom I'm forgetting. You know, they have a lot of those young guys on the roster already. And it's tough to say, you know, that I know exactly which players are in and out with them. But obviously, you know, they are a team that's trying to win. They can keep turning over that back part of their roster to do it. How high can they get? I mean, I know, you know, Atlanta is the team you hear all the time listening openly for number six. Maybe they can get to number six. Like, and maybe there's a player who they like at that spot. That's maybe something to look at. There are other teams in the lottery also looking to move back. So if that is something that's there, maybe they do it. Or maybe instead they look at a deal. Well, hey, maybe we will kick the can down the road. We'll trade one of our firsts for a future first. That's a similar pick with protections, right? Like something like that could just be a simple way to say, you know, we'll just save this for later.
So LaMelo Ball is probably the most interesting player or draws the most interest in this draft because of his last name and his family history with the NBA. But is he the player with the most variance at the top of the draft? Is he the guy that could wind up going, you know, 2, 3, or 4, or if I don't want to fall all the way down to, you know, 10, 12, 11? I mean, I guess it's two questions. One, what is the perception of LaMelo Ball as we speak right now? And is he the player with the most variance in the top half of the first round?
Yeah, you hear a lot of mixed opinion, but I don't think anyone doubts the talent level with him. And so I think he's viewed as a player who is not going to fall too far because there's a juncture where you just have to do it and see what happens. I don't know if necessarily that means that he is the guy Minnesota would want. My position has been, and my hunch has been, that that's not what will happen. But Chicago, if he makes it to Chicago, like, I think that's a real conversation that they have. Even Cleveland at number five, like, maybe if he's there, you're just like, man, I know we have guards, but maybe we take him and make another move.
Yeah,
right?
Draft another small guard for...
Well, LaMelo is not a small guard.
Well, right? Point guard, I guess. Playmaking, whatever it
right,
is.
Right, right. But he's different. He's different than those guys. And I would rather have LaMelo than Colin Sexton, right? So maybe if you take LaMelo... see what happens with that, and you trade Sexton for something like a pick up an asset in the back of the first round. Like, I'm speculating here, but I'm just thinking of ways you could talk yourself into it. That 4 or 5 range. You know, Charlotte is a team that often I've heard does not really have so much interest in LaMelo. So I don't know. You know, I think they're still supposed to meet with him. I'm not sure, you know, what's going to happen there. Maybe they change their mind. Maybe they reverse course and say, let's do it. And I think that's totally would be a good pick for them at three. But I don't see him falling much further than like 5 or 6. Like it would just be, it would be crazy. Like he's good enough, even with the question marks about, you know, his personality and just, you know, his maturity and the shooting. You know, even with those questions, I still can't see him falling too far because it's not so bad that you wouldn't try it.
So is he the player that, you know, that has that most variance that, you know, could bounce up and down the board?
To an extent, yes. I think within the lottery, I think his range is probably, I mean, if you are operating under my assumption that I don't think he goes one, then his range is probably not that, I don't think his variance is that wide because it's kind of that range right after the top three, or maybe it's 3 through 6. So maybe not as wide as you might think. Like it would be stunning if he fell like into the back of the lottery, and that would also just be dumb. It's going to be interesting to see. I mean, I think there are players in the first round with wider ranges that you could point to, like maybe like a Tyrese Maxey. But LaMelo is just going to be interesting to see who the team is that ends up getting him and how they end up getting there to take him.
So any other players that, I mean, look, maybe it's a different question. When you look back at, you know, let's say last couple of years draft, was Michael Porter Jr., you know, falling to the back half of the lottery, Bol Bol falling into the second round. Are there those guys that could plummet for whatever reason, whether it's health or love for the game or whatever it is that are the factors there?
Yeah. So I have not heard too much yet about medical. I think teams are still reviewing that. I'm sure, you know, for different reasons that stuff will start maybe trickle out in the next week, but I can't speak too much to that perspective with it. But it seems like for the most part, you know, the guys who are at the top of the draft seem to be fairly clean from what I understand, but yeah, again, that could change. I don't know everything there, but I think it's possible now. There are two guys who, you know, I had thought might have been closer to the top five who may fall into that next group. I would look at Isaac Okoro, who I think might end up now more in that 7 through 11 range, and then Obi Toppin, who I think, you know, I thought was going to be a top five pick, and now with the way this dynamic has changed a little bit at the top of the draft, I think now there's a chance that he does make it down to New York at number 8, which I think that's probably his floor. And I'm not the first person to say this, but you know, I think New York is a team that definitely would be happy walking away with Toppin. So, you know, maybe he does make it to them after all. But those are a couple of names where I could see Okoro with the shooting factor and not being able to work out. So he can't really as easily show the progress. And then Toppin just being an older guy who's more of an NBA ready guy, but not as much of like, depending who you talk to, maybe not like a future upside guy in that range. But I could see those two guys falling a little bit further than we think or might have thought at least like a few weeks ago.
So being NBA ready is often a challenge because many of these guys are, you know, first year of college, second year of college, and then done. But if you look at the guys that could make an impact early next season and be a factor on a team, whether it's a playoff team or otherwise, who makes some sense? Who fits that description?
Yeah, we can start with Toppin. I mean, defensively, he has to, you know, prove he can do it. But offensively, he's pretty much ready to contribute in terms of the shooting. He's athletic. He's going to run the floor. And it's nice. It's just nice to have big, so you can play in a lot of different types of spots. Where, you know, he's nominally a big, but he can play in the corner. You can use him as a ball screen guy. He can, you know, flash out and kind of just, you can use him for different things because he's a good enough shooter to do it. I think Obi, and also, you know, being an older player, I think he's one that will come up. Sadiq Bey from Villanova, probably back lottery, doesn't make it out of the top 20, but more in like the, you know, I would say the 12 to 20 range. I think he's a guy who teams think, coming out of Villanova, more of a reliable guy who can help, and also a little bit of an older player. And if we're talking like high lottery, I mean, I think Onyeka Okongwu, his game is pretty well suited for the NBA right now, just from a defensive standpoint. He plays a pretty unflashy style, but I think it's going to work in that, like a role capacity early on. So I think he's a guy to a team could view like we're going to take him and kind of hope we get 25-ish minutes a game from him and don't lose too much. So it's not a draft that's like chock full of those guys until you kind of get further down into like the you know 25 to 40 where you're looking at college guys like Xavier Tillman or like a Cassius Winston, the older college prospects, or like a Desmond Bain. Like those are guys who I think teams are interested in and viewed as guys who can help early on. But in the lottery, it's not like there are a ton of guys where I'm like, this guy's definitely going to help on day one.
So let's talk about Wiseman for a second, because I mean, he's the one guy I can talk with any authority on, having written about him for the magazine. And that story is up online right now. And look, I liked what I saw from him, you know, watching the three games he played at Memphis and talking to a lot of people about his game. And, you know, he does have that super athletic frame. I do believe that he will gravitate out towards the three-point line at some point in his career and become a stretch five. Some of the knocks on him, Jeremy, were a little bit strange to me. Like, he got that, you know, does he love the game knock from a few people I talked to. And oftentimes that goes to a guy that's really smart. And James Wiseman seems really smart. Like, he's he's a thinker. You know, he reads a lot. He speaks conversational Mandarin. I mean, the guy's got a lot going for him intellectually. And I think sometimes, you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I think sometimes when guys have stuff going on off the court, you know, sometimes some teams bristle at that, where they want them just to be just basketball all the time. But I watch Wiseman's game, and I talked to Penny Hardaway about him as well, and Penny knows big man talent. And when Penny, you know, the time Penny had him at Memphis, they would sit down and watch old Shaq tapes, because I don't think Wiseman was aware of just how athletic Shaq was in the early part of his career. I mean, Shaq in the mid-90s was a monster running the floor. Like, he was as athletic as any big in the NBA. It wasn't the stationary target we saw in the 2000s. He was great. And, you know, Wiseman, I think, gravitated towards that and sees himself, you know, as that type of player. So, sometimes you get fooled by, you know, getting a little bit too close to guys that you know, write profiles about. You get a little bit too confident in their abilities. But as far as big men go, I think he's got all the ingredients to be a big-time player in the NBA. What's your perception of him, and what's the general perception around the NBA of Wiseman?
So, yeah, I don't disagree with it either. I think like sometimes there is a stigma, you know, with the, you know, doesn't love the game thing. I agree with that. But with him, I do think it dates back. It's not just that. I think it does date back a little bit to high school, where he was always very highly ranked. But sometimes, and especially with bigs at young ages, they don't always seem like challenged. So sometimes you don't see like the competitive fire on a consistent basis. You know, a lot of big guys have to sort of learn how to dominate the game, and sort of like develop that. And I think with him, that was kind of the perception a little bit, where, you know, I've heard different scouts being like, yeah, I just can't shake like the memory of him getting, you know, beat by XYZ guy at XYZ event. So like, the impression that he left, you know, before college, I think basically if it had been stronger, it probably would have been an easier sell. Like, this guy's for sure number one, even in a league where centers are not quite as valued as they once were. Now, I do think the conversation at one point kind of went too far in the other direction. Like, look, this is still a guy who's going to be productive. You just look at his body, like, you know, he kind of has like the young Dwight Howard kind of like look in terms of, you know, being in really good shape, being able to run the floor. You know, he's going to have to keep getting more flexible and mobile on defense. But there's not a lot that he can't really do. And I agree with you that he's going to, you know, continue to kind of float out to the perimeter. And look, that's not a problem if he makes the threes. But the problem has been, at a young age, that was his tendency, was, you know, people thought he wanted to be a unicorn, is what the kids say, right? But people thought that he wanted to kind of be, you know, a skill big, like the big guard-itis sometimes is what I call it. It's one of my pet peeves sometimes with guys too. But look, as long as he understands he can do that, but he has to work into that, I think he'll be okay. And well, just from a tools perspective, you know, he checks all those boxes. Now, would I be a little scared to pick him? Maybe, just because, you know, you're still waiting for sure to see him dominate consistently. And, you know, it would have been great to have him just see him do it. Even if he had played 10 games at Memphis and played a few games against better competition than just the one good game he had was against Oregon, right? So I think that's why there's a little bit of, it's hard to find people who are like, we're definitely both feet in. But you know, I do think, you know, definitely going to be a top two pick. I don't see him falling further than that, really. And
I think Charlotte really likes him. I think you touched on that at the top, but I think Charlotte really likes him. I can't see him getting past Charlotte number three.
Yeah, and I think he I mean, my guess is he'll go before them. Yeah. So,
yeah, that'll be interesting. Good big man prospect. They aren't as bad as they used to be, but they still can be pretty impactful if they can do a lot of different things, which Wiseman at least has the potential to ultimately do. Jeremy, always appreciate your time, man. I know it's going to be a busy week. You can check out Jeremy's stuff all week long on SI.com. We'll have complete draft coverage on Wednesday, November 18th on SI.com. Keep up the good work, man. I know it's going to be a wild week for you.
All right, man. I appreciate it. Same to you.